Case 94 from the Book of Serenity. Introduction. The lower do not discuss the higher. The base do not move the noble. Even if you can control yourself and follow others, you still cannot toil at the heavy by means of the light. When the physical elements are out of tune, how does one attend and nurture? The case. When Dongshan was unwell, a monk asked, "You are ill, teacher, but is there anyone who does not get ill?" Dongshan said, "There is." The monk said, "Does the one who is not ill look after you?" Dongshan said, "I have the opportunity to look after him." The monk said, "How is it when you look after him?" Dongshan said, "Then I don't see that he has any illness." And from the verse, when the meadow streams are thin, the autumn ponds recede. Where the white clouds end, the old mountains are cold. You must cut off absolutely. Don't be big-headed. Evolving to the utmost effortlessness, he attains to the state. The lone standout is not in the same class as you. So taking up again this matter of intimacy, this matter of being human, this matter of what does it mean to be alive, and our lovely five remembrances that have snuck into our sutra service from those nasty Theravadins. I guess they have something going for them. But one commentary on the five remembrances said the remembrance of that we will get sick is to cure the arrogance of health. And the reminder that we will get old is to cure the arrogance of the young. And the reminder that we will die is to cure the arrogance of those who are living. So maybe our Zazen is about curing this arrogance. This matter of Dongshan. Generally, and I think this is the case, when it says the master was unwell, usually it means he's about to croak. It's not that he had the sniffles today. This is really to the heart of it. So the master is there about to die. And the disciple comes in and states the obvious, you are ill. And says, is there someone who does not get ill? Perhaps some arrogance here, but perhaps some genuine questioning. I think it's Jack Kornfeld who tells the story of his teacher Ajahn Chah, and when Ajahn Chah was very sick, Jack went to be with him, and they were sitting together in silence, and Jack said something about the vastness of space, and here we are, and no problem. And Ajahn Chah said, easy for you to say. Easy for you to say. And so it is with all of us. Easy to say. Easy to say when we're healthy. Easy to say when there is clarity. But when sickness comes, when the unexpected comes, then how do we be intimate with this? And we talk about turning towards it. And of course, this is dangerous business, turning toward, because if we get too close, or if we identify totally with the state we're in, and this is what happens for all of us, we enter these mind states where there is no outside. We are totally consumed by our story. Taken over. We sometimes talk about realms, so that all of us are fairly reasonable people most of the time, but then when our partner looks at us just the wrong way, when our parent answers the phone with that tone in his voice for the millionth time, when whatever, we sometimes get thrown under the bus of life. There we are, the big 10-wheeler. I don't know how many wheels buses have, but it's a lot when you're under them. And there we are, and we think, all right, I just need to think my way out of this. I'm really, okay, here I am, and I'm going to think my way out. I'm going to work really hard. God damn it, here I am again. And there we are. We are unwell. And so this wonderful question, when you are totally carried away by your pain, when you are totally carried away by dullness or confusion, is there one who is not dull? Is there one who is not angry? This is the invitation for intimacy that is different than total fusion. There is an intimacy of meeting and staying in the proper place, host and guest. So host is the field of awareness, guest is the what arrives. When the guest takes over, it's a problem. Then the air conditioner is not adjusted correctly. Then the windows get open and closed at random intervals instead of the proper intervals. So host is this awareness and this lovely invitation, this lovely invitation to intimacy with our whole lives.
I've sat with a lot of friends who have died over the years now. And still, the one of the many flooding images in my heart, I think of Bob Jessup. He died of AIDS back when people died of AIDS. And he was a very loving human being and was very much loved. And many people in that last hard time would come to visit him. And there really is something powerful when we visit somebody who is dying. A lot of nonsense, for many of us, a lot of nonsense burns away. For some of us, it doesn't. I found myself, I tend to be a little bit like the monk. I like to name it right up. My God, you look like shit. It turns out, fortunately for me, most of my friends can work with that. In his case, this was in California, and it's in a little pocket of hyper-New Age-ness. And a lot of people had stories they really wanted to work with Bob. And he fell quickly into this pattern that he welcomed anybody to visit. But if somebody started into the left field, into their own stuff, he didn't really have time for that. And he would thank them and say, I really can't visit with you anymore. And send them away to their own reflection on the great matter. For me, the one that I recall most vividly and perhaps relevant to our moment here is the person who came, who had a whole raft of beliefs about processing and wanted to engage him in the range of emotions and the path he was taking, if I recall correctly, informed loosely by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's Stages of Death. He listened patiently for a few minutes. He thanked her and said, let's not visit again. And she said, no, you can't. You have to process this. And I still recall that pause, that deep thundering silence. And from that silence, he said, I am the process. Sent her on the way and let her process that. So our monk says, you are ill. I love that. I think that's cool. Maybe because, as I said, I like to say that. But then he's got this Zen assholeness about him. This is his teacher, after all, and if you can't impose upon your teacher when they're doing something as minor as dying, who can you impose upon? Is there anyone who does not get ill? From his deathbed, there is. Does this one who is not ill look after you? What dream upon dream? What strange and mysterious and beautiful and haunting and stupid things are living in that monk's heart? What is he reaching for here? We can assume he's an old hand. We can assume he's even tasted awakening. But this is how he asks it. Does the one who is not ill look after you? Dongshan invites him back with his own response. He says, I have the opportunity to look after him. Our gathering here, these days and hours that we spend, I believe are all about that point, the opportunity to look after him.
So as I was listening to David and James, it's always an interesting position to be in, this third place, taking the third seat in the Dharma talk. So both of them so complete, and both of them so heartful in meeting this condition that will come to us all. Right now, it's easy for us to say. The reality of it, of course, we know, is mysterious. And I often think of the story that I heard about Katagiri Roshi, Dosho Port's teacher, when he was dying. And you know these famous last words, and here's somebody in the 20th century, so maybe this happened. But his students, all distraught, hanging around his bed, saying, variations of what we say. We don't want you to die. know, is there one, who knows what they asked, but very, very distraught. And he looked up at all of them, and apparently his final words to them were, "I don't want to die." Thank you. So please make yourselves comfortable and we'll have our Dharma Dharma.
Diane, then Derek.
So, just before I came to Sabina, I was watching an HBO documentary about some elderly people who had moved to Florida from New York and New Jersey, and they had left lives where they felt unsafe where they were living and wanted to go somewhere warm where it was easier for them. And so it followed these people, and so much of what we've been talking about this week, you know, was revealed in these lives of people who experienced so much longing and so much lack of intimacy, and they were very elderly and still at the end of their life, still searching. And there was one woman who was interviewed, and she had become very sick, and she said that all of these people with whom she had been, you know, playing mahjong and going to dancing lessons, none of them would come visit her. And but she said one woman came. And she said, "Well, I'm already dying, so it doesn't matter to me." Mm-hmm. And I just thought, oh, you know, here's someone who, you know, already, she experienced the great death, and so out of that she could show her deep kindness. So I think that is so much of what we're practicing here is, you know, the great death that allows us to become intimate and maybe a little helpful. Everything you said is so resonant with that show.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, and that non-separation. Mm-hmm. So we see it when we sit, we're practicing being present with life in all its forms. So when it's a friend, when it's an acquaintance, mm-hmm. then already dying, all of us. Yeah, thank you. Derek, Mike?
You know, it amazes me that Katagiri Roshi, you know, practiced for so long and was such an attained teacher, and, you know, even he wasn't like, "Oh, it's okay."
I think that's what I love about the story, you know, the this is intimacy. This is, you know, I think about what James said about the monk who had all these dreams in his heart about what it means to be awake, and, you know, maybe there's this one who can take care of me, and, you know, and the ponies and the rainbows. And, really been stuck on these ponies and rainbows. I don't know what that's all about. But, it, you know, the reality is, you know, I can imagine that myself, being surrounded by beloved students and friends, and his wife was probably there, and his children, and I don't want to die. You know, that's to me a real Zen statement. It's that intimacy.
Mike.
Talking about the whole living in this story really resonates with my experience with my mother a couple of years ago. She and I didn't always get along really well, and she was one of those people that had very fixed ideas about how life should be, how living should be. And she was suddenly diagnosed with terminal cancer, and she literally had to leave her home. She had to shave her head, and this was not her idea of how her life should be. And I kept at first trying to fix how she processed this. Wow. Those are just things. You know. Until, you know, at one point I just said, I just got to let her be how she's going to be and just hug her when she's with her and just be with her. And we had, she continued to struggle with it. She still wasn't letting go of it, but we end up having a very close, intimate moment, like one of the very few I can count in our life, when she came to stay with me for a short bit. And still, being with her through that process of death, she was the first person I sort of was there with through the whole process. And I could just see how uncomfortable and annoying it is. And she, her last word to me, actually, was "fuck." And,
maybe she too had attained the
goal. Yeah, yeah, it really sounds like Zen master material.
Okay, it was just, yeah, ma. Yeah, goodbye.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sharon, yeah. Dominic?
Yeah, sorry. That was a really intense story. I was just going to follow up on a question from James. You said that what we do in that session is to look after the one who's not sick. And it's a really gentle way of saying it. And I wonder if you can say more about the quality of that looking after.
Sure. Of course, for here, we're meeting several deaths, as we always are. Yeah. Last week, I turned 65. By every conventional marker of our culture, I am now officially old. That has led me to, even more than my usual morbid self, to contemplate mortality. So it's kind of hanging there as part of this conversation. And we use this language to speak of something else, of what we in our community often call the boundless, the empty, the void, the shunyata, part of our reality, of reality where... all concepts and ideas and words collapse like an object passing too near a black hole, sucked into it and gone. There is, for us, a really good reason we look at our personal mortality in that same place with emptiness, because it's gone. It's lost. It's completely obliterated. Although each of those, even lost and gone and obliterated, are lost and gone and obliterated. We here are little spaceships going really close to black holes. And we're courting that swallowing. Where even swallow is lost. So the image of our personal mortality and the image of this place are, you know, really, really, really close. And then we have to look at this additional reality. We're pushed. What was it? I was talking with Melissa and David about typologies of koan and how they are arbitrary, and we do our best to kind of map them out because it's helpful. It has a certain utility, but they're only provisional and partial. And of the typologies, they mentioned that ran a workshop in which they had two. It reduced all koan work to two, that I thought was just absolutely powerful and really useful. Who am I? What is this?
and here, who am I and what is this? We pick the gate we want to go in, it's going to swallow us up. And as we sit here on the pillows, as we actually engage our practice, whether it is following our breath, just sitting, engaging, whatever koan it is, we are those little spaceships. You know? Not actually trying to escape the black hole. We're heading straight into it. And then I want a word of, a word with that is, and what makes this story and what makes Katagiri Roshi so poignant and beautiful with his I don't want to die in that particular, I think it was so important that you mentioned, he must have been able to see the joy of life and the beauty of life, of his family and his friends and his students, and how absolutely fragile and temporary it all is, and yet it is. There is complete life. There's also eternal life in this. This moment of losing our life, and for me, the sesshin, these opportunities that we throw ourselves into, confront these two realities in ways that hardly anything else in our lives allow us to encounter. As I have my own experience of these last couple of days, it takes me back to, I'm constantly realizing what David was talking about, with that intimacy. It's intimacy with our mortality, it's intimacy with this thing that absorbs, collapses, destroys all words and ideas, and its intimacy with my personal sore knees and my own longings and my own regrets and my own life. For me, this room becomes hell and becomes heaven. That any use? Paul.
Yeah, this is always an interesting topic for me as far as this issue around life and death.
not for me.
Maybe for others as well. Maybe I was a strange kid, but I was rather fascinated with the concept of death, and really explored it and thought about it, and even into adulthood, my poor early students, it wasn't uncommon for me to bring up the topic at some point about death. And what I'm finding is that as I get older, that I'm much more interested in life. And the simple beauties of life. And there's this poem by David Ludville, who Aaron introduced me to. And unfortunately, I'm not in a position to recite it, but what he's talking about is that the seasons, so in this case, spring, summer, fall, winter, we're meant to see them so we can understand our own death, our own life, and our own death. And at the time that he wrote this poem, I guess he was 58, because he points out that even though he's seen this 58 times, he wants life even more. And I guess that's what I hear, that can appreciate, can maybe even be interested in our own death, and still loving life. Loving life. I think that's what we do here. Mm-hmm.
said. Thank you.
And Paul, I think you point out that this, usually it's a dichotomy. And so we say, well, it's morbid to talk about death, you know. And but I think the, as James was saying, this happens on every scale and happens at every moment. And the person who we were in this morning's zazen is not the person who's listening to the talk. And when we begin to see that, then the world is no longer this linear thing that we're moving along, but the vastness of each moment and the aliveness of the life and the death. We have access to that. And so William James talked about once born and twice born religions. Once born religions, Dale Carnegie, and the working with the mind. You know, we think positive thoughts. We need to, you know, realize that everything's one and it's true, and we'll do that. Twice born religions are where death is part of their requirement, right? That there is someone, and we talk about the sword that gives life and the sword that cuts through delusion. There is some dying that is necessary here. One of the gifts of Zen, I think, is these two, we begin to see they aren't separate, this life and death, and that there is this, for all of us coming here, this great longing for what we've tasted, for what we know. And I think as we deepen, at least for me, the love and the appreciation grows for this, you know, such a rare opportunity. You know, this napkin, this spoonful.
And I think it goes back to the television show you saw, Diane, and that woman saying, "I'm already dead." So, you know, that some, if we push death away, it comes back to haunt us continually. It's like pushing anger away and trying to be nice, pushing greed away and trying to be generous. But this intimacy that we're talking about really allows what you're talking about, Paul, for me anyway, when I can really let myself acknowledge that I'm going to die. Then I see that mostly that acknowledgement is a bit of a fantasy, because I'm not dead now, so I can really be alive. But if I'm constantly thinking, oh, how am I going to prevent death, which I do spend some time thinking about, it saps the life out of everything. And so this is sort of, you know, like the cup is already broken. Some of you know that story. You know, everything we have is in our hands briefly, including our own life. So this is our best season. I saw Anne's.
Yeah, Anne?
Two things, just to add to the last words conversation. My grandmother, a couple hours before she died, we were in the room together, and she said, "I'm nervous."
Oh, that's very tender.
Yeah, and of course.
Yeah.
And then my other thought was, and I don't mean this in a flip way at all, but just out of curiosity, that it's amazing that we still spend so much, that death is still such a big thing for us, even though we've been doing it for a really long time. And we know it's going to happen to all of us, and yet somehow it doesn't lose its...
Yeah. The power of human beings to be in denial is just enormous. That's a great point.
William.
Actually, I had a friend who, she's a therapist and she works in a senior, it's a senior citizens home. She says the most common theme there amongst the people is how surprised they are to be old. That they look in the mirror and they're just always a little shocked by the face that looks back at them. And this is such a evocative kind of topic for me. I'm a nurse. I work in an emergency room right now. I worked in intensive care unit before that. So I've been with a lot of people as they've died. And in the emergency room, it's very shocking. It's sudden. But in the intensive care unit, most of the time, we knew it was coming. And there was a lot of take the family through it, kind of talk about what's going on. And so I've done the whole thing, you know. But at the same time, I think about my friend and the folks who are in the old folks home looking in the mirror being surprised. Like, I've taken people through this process, and then I've gone home and had dinner. Mm-hmm. And I always wonder, like, if the roles are flipped, is any of this experience I've had going to make any difference? Or am I going to be like, what the hell? I have a very long list of ways I do not want to die. And I have no control over whether I end up on that list or not. And it's just something I always kind of wonder. It's that little bit of room of, like, how surprised am I going to be when this happens to me? Because it seems like everybody is. Yeah, we just don't want it to be us. And we know it is. I love the fire. And I hope they finish.
I just want to underline the point I touched on a moment ago, because I think you were pulling it out. Every time we think about death, it is a fantasy. And you know, hopefully it will be surprising. I mean, that's the hope. We can't imagine what it'll be like, but we persist in it. And I just want to make sure that we know that when we talk about death, the tendency of the mind is to move quickly forward to an imagined fantasy of our own death and move backward to all the deaths we've experienced. But the reality is it's right here. This is all we know. And we were talking about what we sometimes call the great death, which has to happen now. You know, the death of all of our clinging to our concepts about what is so. I think that's part of what we're caring for here in the Sangha.
So Mike and Holly.
Yeah. Kind of as a compass-oriented thing for me with practice has often been this non-dual quality of life. But when we talk about guest and host, it sounds dualistic, but I don't really think it is. And I was just wondering if you could say more about that.
Yeah.
Just to add to that, one of the things that one time Josh said to me that has really stuck, and I've loved it. He says duality does not hinder non-duality, and I love that. It really.
Right.
So anyway, I was wondering if you could talk about that with host and guest.
Yeah, I'd say duality does not hit.
That's brilliant.
Maybe a little more intimately.
To me, it gets into this essential teaching of codependent arising. So from the normal mind, we see ourselves and the world out there. And we imagine that it's like this big stage, and I run around to different parts of the stage, and then at some point I'll exit, and the stage will be here. Right? So that seems quite reasonable until we look at our own experience. And this teaching of the Buddha is pointing out that the self and the world create each other. So when we really listen to the sound of the chainsaws in the neighbor's yard, this formulation, I hear the chainsaws, if we really try to find the one who hears the chainsaw, and if we really look at where is the chainsaw, the chainsaw of the heart. The chainsaw's buzzing in my heart. Or we might say the bird is singing in my heart. But of course, host and guest, just a way to look at it, subject and object. We can also say big self, little self. But so big self is, we could say, is oneness, and we can get lost, only oneness. But oneness knows itself through two-ness. Two-ness knows itself through oneness. And this is the dance of life. And so little self takes care of big self. Big self takes care of little self. And they're never separate for an instant. All this, you know, just words in that moment of no need to talk about stuff like this. Yeah. So, thank you, Holly.
Talking about taking care of the one who is not sick. Brought up a story about to my grandfather who died 2 years ago, and I wasn't told how sick he was, and was not invited or included in his dying, and my mother was not encouraged to come and participate, and my aunt and my uncle and my grandmother took care of my grandfather as he was dying, and the only information that I got from them was that it was bad, with no details, or very little details, maybe a few details from my mother from when she visited when he started to get sick. And, you know, my understanding is that they were trying to protect us, my mother and me, from the badness, whatever that was. And recently, you know, 2 years down the line after he passed away in the funeral, all of that. My mother told me 2 years later she has a cry. And I feel gently. Is that it?
So we all have an idea of how it should happen. And in the moment, I feel the genuineness of your heart breaking. That is the perfection of this moment. And you present that as your gift. You don't hide it away, do you? And then all of us don't get chipped. So thank you for showing.
Is there something else?
Let me close with just one line from the verse. The second to last line, evolving to the utmost effortlessness. Evolving to the utmost effortlessness. So James talked about how do we care for the moment? How do we be intimate? And this lovely invitation to let what is here be here. Not to have to manage it. Not to have to wonder if it's the right thing. This is the effortless effort, utmost effortlessness. Thank you.